There are some books that just demand a couple of days on the couch, reading, and not pulling away. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Today we talk with two authors whose books tell such good stories, with palpable settings and characters that are just finely drawn. Donaldson Brown's novel, Because I Loved You, is a decade-spanning epic story of love and loss, romance, and horses. And we'll talk with Donaldson in just a minute. Come Away From Her is Samuel Gailey's latest novel, which on the surface is a murder mystery, but the careful and penetrating portrayal of a small community in eastern Pennsylvania when a stranger arrives in the cold of March presents unforgettable characters and relationships. Stay with us for my conversations with Donaldson Brown and Samuel W. Gailey. Two lovers are brought together through shared dreams of escaping their rural East Texas existence and through their love of horses. Because I Loved You spans decades from 1972 and the Vietnam War through the 1980s New York art scene right through to more recent pre-pandemic times. The author is Donaldson Brown, and her renderings of place and of each character are nuanced and precise. Donaldson has been writing for some time, screenplays and spoken word pieces, and this is her first novel. Let's listen to our conversation. I am so happy that you're joining me today to talk about this. Donaldson Brown, Because I Loved You, your really epic novel. It spans over 40 years in the lives of these characters, and it spans locations too. Yet there's also kind of a containment and an intimacy that feels very close. So let's start off talking about what interests you in telling a story that is at once this big yet this intimate.
First of all, Suzanne, it's such a pleasure to be here and to be on your program. I really appreciate it. It's a privilege. So thank you for having me. Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that I am really an intuitive writer. Sometimes you'll hear people ask, are you an outliner or do you write by the seat of your pants? And I definitely fall onto the seat of the pants side of the scale. And so these characters came to me and their lives unfolded. So I followed it. And I think really at its core, the story is really about love, not just a love story, but it's about love, which is an expansive experience. And so I think that's really how the story unfolded. And also a love of place. I think I want to say that too, you know, a love of land, a love of place. And so evoking that and bringing that out for the characters was important to me too.
The story begins in East Texas with horses and big landscapes. And I think you grew up there too, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe you can talk about that part of the country. Well, let's just start there and we'll build from there.
Sure. Well, actually, one thing, I spent time in Northeast Texas, actually in the area where the novel opens. Most of my growing up, however, was in Southern Connecticut. It's a very different landscape and a very different culture, and which I'm sure is part of why the time that I did spend in Texas, my father and his siblings had a ranch in Northeast Texas. So that was a very impactful time for me. And I always loved horses. I grew up riding both in Connecticut and in Texas. So I loved being there and I loved the cowboys and I loved hearing the cowboys' stories and I loved the terrain and landscape and the expansiveness of it and the weather. The weather in Texas was so wild. I remember seeing cyclones, spinning across the horizon. Everything about it was really very moving and impactful. So that was kind of my geographic upbringing. And I think maybe just to set the stage a little bit for listeners, the story, as you said, Suzanne, it opens in a very small ranching town in Northeast Texas in 1972 against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. And there are sort of two horse crazy teenagers who have dreams that are a little too big for their small town. And tragedy forces them to make a decision, really, when they're very young, but decisions that will reverberate throughout their lives. And the novel then jumps, the middle section of the novel takes place in New York City in 1986, in the mid-1980s. And that's a time in New York where the downtown art scene is really burgeoning, as is the sort of Reagan era financial boom. And then the novel concludes in pre-pandemic current times, and that the final section bounces a little bit between New York City and upstate New York, sort of rural upstate New York.
It has a sweeping scope that way, yet the things that the characters are dealing with, and I'll say that the main characters are Caleb and Lenny, and they have these bigger ideas of what life is and what they can be, but they're rather constrained in that setting. And then when they meet each other, it just is seems like such a natural love relationship for them. But they experience, as many young people do, they experience loss at a time that is in their teenage years. And loss is something that is a common thing we all experience, but it is what we all experience so uniquely, and it defined their lives, really, and even for Lenny, her art in a way. And so talk a little bit about loss and how defining that is in their lives and in our lives, really.
Yeah, that's a theme that really interests me as a human being and as a writer. It dovetails with something that I wanted to pursue from the get-go, which is following one's dream and not. And I think in some ways, our desires, what we want to do when we're young people, can often really reflect our heart's desire, sometimes maybe, really profound desires and aptitudes and all. So I was curious about Lenny and Caleb, about how one character really does stay true to their dreams and pursues them, and the other character kind of gets derailed, makes other choices. So that was one thing I was interested in terms of the impact of loss, or a tragedy, sort of a major event like that.
Lenny's mother is a war bride from the Second World War. She was French. And she lost her whole family during the war. And as sort of an escape or reinvention, she marries and is then living in East Texas. And I thought that it was really interesting to see the evolution of her relationship with her daughter, both her daughters, but with her daughter, Lenny. And that in some ways, there was something similar about them in that early loss and in looking for freedom. And that relationship between the mother and daughter, I just found very interesting and real. So maybe do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think Lenny and her mom, that's a difficult relationship when we meet Lenny. She's a teenager. She's headstrong. She's a little embarrassed by her mom. She thinks that her mom is sort of old-fashioned. Her mom carries with her, of course, some of her, European old country, I'm going to say, ways. And she felt very constrained by her mom and misunderstood. And Lenny's older sister, so this is 1972. Again, as I said, there's the novel opens. So there's also an era of real social change, and it's, making its way even to very, very rural small town, Northeast Texas. And her sister actually decides to make a change and at some point and leave and head west. And I was really interested in Lenny's mother's response to that development as well. And that forced me to think about the choices that Lenny's mom, Ludvine, made when she was only 19, and to, come to the United States. And so how that sort of pattern played out. And then as the novel goes on, Lenny does, reconcile with her mother. And I think they do come to an understanding. I think the novel also, I hope, has, a lot of tones of forgiveness and understanding too. And I think Lenny's mom, she went through a terrible tragedy, as you mentioned, in the surviving the war in Normandy in northern France during World War II. So there's a scene where she's talking with Lenny about loss and about how the choices one has to make with loss and a way in which we all have to carry on. And I think Ludvine was saying that to Lenny in what she hoped would be a supportive, kind of loving way. We have to carry on. And then she also realizes that in her experience of loss in the war, there was, if you will, almost a community sense about it. Everybody was going through the war. Whereas Lenny's loss, what happens to her, is really almost private. It's on another scale. And her mother comes to realize that, something of the isolation of dealing with the loss in the way that Lenny has to.
There's another character in the book, Hank Jr. This is Cal's brother. And he comes back from the war in Vietnam, and he's a changed person and misunderstood in a certain way. Yet Lenny seems to see through that, and he connects with her too. And I thought that he was an interesting character in that you could see his, I don't know, his outlaw behavior, but also his big heart as well. And so talk a little bit about that, because I don't know, I just think your depiction of those times in the 70s was so, and for teenagers and young people at that time, was really so searing in a way. And I think that maybe we have forgotten how, for youth at the time, it was really hard to see people go off and come back, these changed people. So talk a little bit about Hank Jr.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing up Hank Jr. I love him. and he does have a big heart, and he came back from the war and, the tragedies that he saw. And I think, war, there's what one sees and what one does, and there's the moral injury of it, and it's a tangle for sure. And we all know that our culture dealt particularly with those who were coming back from the Vietnam War in a in an unfortunate way. And I think, jumping to Caleb for a second, he's 17 when the novel opens, and again it's 1972. So, he's got the specter of the draft, over his head. So anytime he's thinking about the future at that point in time, he's like, he doesn't know. He doesn't know what his number's going to be. I grew up with three older brothers who were all draft age during Vietnam. So I remember that specter sort of viscerally. And I think Lenny's connection with Hank, it's interesting. He's older. He's scary, but he's also, there's a charisma to him as well. And he takes Lenny as an equal. So that's of course, intriguing to her too, you know, sort of intimidating and intriguing and all of that. And in time of need, he steps up, and really nobody else knows that at the time. He's got a tough road to hoe, you know, coming home. And the relationship with his father is also difficult because, as you said, you know, he's misunderstood. Nobody can really fathom what he's dealing with. You know, we're coming some ways to understanding, you know, post-traumatic stress, but back then it was really not on the forefront of the medical establishment or the culture's consciousness.
Right. And well, the father, Hank's and Caleb's father, Hank Sr., brought himself up, little education, and becomes a successful, wealthy rancher. And he expects his sons, and he especially expects Caleb to enter this life and keep things going. And that is also a early conflict that he has to face, and his relationship with his parents. His mother kind of understands who her boy is, and the father is bitter at Caleb's wanting something else. That is something that I think many families face then and now.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you're right. And I think in Hank Sr.'s case, when I think about Hank Sr., I think what he accomplished in his life, I admire very much. He came out of the Depression and, as you said, was on his own from a very early age and made an extremely successful life, at least financially. And I think often, you know, it's hard to lead a balanced life. And I think sometimes, you know, success and real accomplishment in one area, sometimes we might neglect another. And he was not really parented. He was on his own at such a young age. And I don't think he, you know, really knew how to relate to his boys, you know, emotionally. So he carries this sense of duty, you know, what he expects of his boys. And he's a very, very, very strong presence. And he doesn't really understand Caleb. And interestingly, he has an interesting, you brought up the theme of loss earlier too. And I think one of the scenes where Caleb and his dad have an interesting scene, and actually his dad is really trying to reach out to him and trying to connect with him. And the scene ends with his really telling his son, telling Caleb that he needs to learn to let go of things that he loves, and almost as though that's part of being a man. And in this case, it's Caleb's prized horse, who he's trained, you know, and his father realizes, oh, well, it's a valuable, you know, it's a valuable animal. You know, what would you get for him? And, you know, Caleb's like, it's not for sale, you know. And they don't, that, that's not a, they don't come into conflict in that scene, but it's just sort of, I think, you know, shows the ways in which they're different and the ways in which they approach their lives in different ways.
Well, so we've brought up horses now, and early in the book, Lenny is faced with her mother's going to sell her horse, Foggy, and Lenny runs away with her horse, or that's her inclination. This is not going to happen. And it leads into some episodes where eventually lead to her meeting of Caleb and relationship with him. But in the early part of the book, in the Texas part of the book, and then later on too, horses are very important to them. And your description of their relating with their horses and their love of them is just so lovely and real. And I think you have relationship with horses too, or horses are important in your life. So I enjoyed reading that. And so talk about your love of horses and how you threaded that into the book and why it is so important.
I do love horses, and I grew up riding and didn't have a horse. I don't own a horse now. I haven't for many years, and then didn't ride at all for many, many years, a couple of decades. And I remember one time my husband asking me, "Do you ever think you could really be happy without a horse?" And it took me so by surprise, because he had never even known me when I was, riding seriously. And I thought that was something that I had, hidden and put away. And clearly he understood me better than I gave him credit for. And I guess it wasn't so, I hadn't hidden it so well. And with Lenny and Caleb, though, starting off with them, I think it's one of the things that they recognized and admired about one another from the get-go was their horsemanship and their connection with their horses. And they really recognized that in one another. And horses also do play a part in, throughout the novel. They are kind of woven through the novel. And I now work with an organization in Sharon, Connecticut called the Equus Effect. And we offer sort of experiential learning and a form of somatic experiencing with horses for veterans and first responders and others who are dealing with post-traumatic stress. And I have also come to learn more about the neurobiology of, connecting with animals and with horses in particular. I now have a little bit a different understanding of why it is that some people connect so strongly with horses, and their pulse is half hours. Just putting your hand on a horse can actually be a calming experience. They're extremely adept at recognizing what I almost think of really as intention. A horse is a prey animal, so it can read your heart rate, your respiration rate, and your pulse from 30 to 40 feet away. So they're extremely sensitive and extremely attuned to us. And so when one connects with a horse and when you get their trust, it's a very powerful thing, and it's a wonderful feeling. Yeah, that's why horses came into. And I'll say one other thing. This novel actually started with an image of this girl galloping her gray mare across what I recognized as the chaparral, the Texas chaparral. And I couldn't get her out of my mind. And I just had to ask myself, what is she running from and where is she going? And then the next character that came in all of a sudden was this young man, this boy, and coming into this sprawling brick ranch house. And he's angry and he's drenched. And, well, wow, who's he? How are they connected? And that was the beginning of the story, and just following them from there. And when I reflect back on that, it interests me in some ways that the initial image of Lenny was, she was in movement, always in movement. She was always going to be going for it. And, and Caleb was standing still, and came in. So, it's just interesting how these things evolve.
Well, I loved some of the descriptions. And there's a scene where Lenny's dad is a veterinarian, and she would go on calls with him. And Lenny and her brother Foy find Caleb's horse, who had run because of a storm, and they find him and he's wounded. And I'm hesitant to give too many details away here, Donaldson, because the pleasure of it all unfolding is for the reader. So I don't want to give too much away, but it was just wonderful. Some of those scenes with the horses were just wonderful. So I guess I'm going to let our listeners and readers discover them, especially if they enjoy that sort of thing. I mean, stories of horses and people's relationships with them. And I like what you just said, though, about neurobiology. I just want to do a slight left turn on this. The neurobiology of us, or of the horses, or of both? And why would horses be different, say, than a dog or a cat? Is it because of them being these prey animals that they have this attenuation.
Yes, I think that's a significant, very significant part of it for horses as prey animals, and so how they are scanning their environment and making sense of their environment as opposed to, you know, a cat or a dog, right, who descend from bigger cats and wolves and are predators, really.
Right.
So it is very different. And it's interesting what you ask about the neurobiology for the horses and humans. And I think really the short answer to that question is that there's kind of an entrainment or a coming into sync, as was one way of thinking about it, of, you know, a horse and a human. You know, there are times, I don't know, maybe this will illustrate it in some ways. And if we have a new group of veterans or first responders or whoever who may come into the barn, and, you know, usually might have, you know, four or five people coming into the barn, and it's the first time, and very often they haven't had any experience with horses and they don't really know what they're getting into. And so, you know, the nervous energy is a little bit high, and, you know, the horses are like, you know, heads up, ears forward, you know, some of them might be pacing or circling in their stalls, you know, it's like, what's up here? What do I need to pay attention to? And we always start with some somatic experiencing exercises that are just body scans and just breathing and just tuning into the sensation in our bodies, which can be a very, just coming into sync with ourselves a little bit better. And it's really amazing. Within, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of this, the horses are relaxed, heads down, you know, you hear them, you know, licking and chewing, and they're calm. So they react almost immediately to the energy of the humans around them. They can pick that up. And it does become sort of a two-way street, you know, if a horse is, you know, on edge because it's a really windy day, or, you know, a plastic bag blows in front of their field of vision and they don't know what's going on. And, you know, at the same point, you know, if the human who they know is calm, that'll help them. That'll help the horse. It can actually be a really beautiful thing to watch somebody come into connection with a horse. And if you can often get someone just to lay their hands on the animal and just breathe, can be a real, you know, coming into oneself, which is a very difficult thing after trauma. And I've seen just some real, you know, beautiful releases of energy. And sometimes a veteran or somebody might, you know, take a horse over to one corner of the field and, you know, just talk with them and let them witness, be a witness, you know, they'll hold that for us. So they're beautiful animals. They really are.
Say the name of that organization again.
Oh, sure. Thank you. It's called the Equus Effect, and it's based in Sharon, Connecticut, and where I'm a facilitator with them as well. And so we are expanding the program, and it's a wonderful program.
It is so interesting to see how we've always had, as humans, relationships with horses. But now that we do not need them for our burden or transportation, there's this incredible transformation in how people relate with horses, and your organization kind of exemplifies that. I'm talking with Donaldson Brown. Her book is Because I Loved You, and there are horses in it, so it justifies us talking about horses. But this is an epic tale, and there's something about seeing a large span of a person's life and death. And I wonder, for you as a writer, how that is. You're creating these characters, but they have a life to them that spans time. And just as we might reminisce about our youth, you know, you have it all in this story. And so I guess I'm just curious quickly about your experience as the writer of these characters.
Oh, I have to tell you, I fell in love with all of them.
So did I.
I'm so glad to hear that. And when I first was fortunate enough to get a contract for the book, the thought of bringing them out into the world, I have to tell you, it was frightening. I want to do my best by them, and I am letting them out into the world, and I just feel like they led the way. I guess I'm self-conscious that it sounds kind of airy fairy or something, but they did. And for, you know, everyone has their own process, you know, for their whatever medium they're working in. And when I try to contain a story or force something in a certain way, I really get in my own way and I get in my character's way, and it just doesn't end up feeling honest. And so these characters led the way, and I am in love with all of them.
Because I Loved You is the name of this epic tale, and it is a love story. There's a lot of love, and there's some warm sex in the book too, which is kind of nice to encounter. Donaldson Brown, thank you for talking with us today about your book.
And it's just been such a pleasure to speak with you. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Donaldson Brown, Because I Loved You. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.
Drifting snowflakes shift and chase. I see memories on my face. Traveled the world to forget the past, but money fades and memories last. I can feel the snow falling. I can feel the snow falling.
Set in the snowy chill of March in a small town in eastern Pennsylvania, Samuel W. Gailey tells a tense story with raw and real characters who grapple with truth and decency, loyalty and emotion. The novel is Come Away From Her, his third novel and a follow-on to his book, Deep Winter. Samuel W. Gailey, I'm really happy to talk to you today, and thank you for joining us about your book, Come Away From Her.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to having a discussion today.
You mention that the title of your book is based on the Kiki Smith etching with that title that itself riffs on Alice in Wonderland. And I wonder what inspired you about that work in relation to the story you're telling us here?
That's a great question. With, you know, my story, Tess, one of the main characters, is a young woman that's very lost. And obviously in the Alice in Wonderland story, it's about a young girl that's lost as well. And when I saw Kiki Smith's etched drawing, it just really moved me. The original title for the book was called Black Walnut, that's the town that the story takes place in. And although I love that title, it doesn't mean as much if you're not from there, that area. But just the title, Come Away From Her, really, to me, is a very loaded four words, and it's beautiful. So I think that's why I landed on that title eventually.
It resonates through the whole book. And the book begins with a body and blood and a hangover, and it's a cold and snowy Good Friday, and the main character, Cap, is a Presbyterian minister, and he is the one with the hangover. But then you then take us back a couple of weeks before this day, and we see Cap and the people of this small Pennsylvania town of Black Walnut. And with the exception of a couple of characters, Tess being one of them, everyone else is longtime residents of this place and know each other's lives and histories. And so before we get deep into the story, you are from a small town and have set stories there in the past. So what is it that makes this sort of setting good for fiction? And does what you write about reflect some of your own experience?
Absolutely. I grew up in a small town of about 390 people, maybe 400. And there's a bunch of little hamlets in that Bradford County, Pennsylvania area. And each of these little hamlets is around 400 people. And my first book, Deep Winter, took place in the town of Wyalusing, which is maybe 10 miles from Black Walnut. And like in Deep Winter, the new book takes place in a small community in the 1980s. And when you grow up in a community like that, especially in the 1980s when there wasn't a lot of technology, there's tremendous isolation in living there. And most people that I went to school with never leave that area. You know, they continue farming their family's farm, or they work at a meatpacking plant in the area, and they never leave. So there's, you know, this sense of isolation, and you will never get out, never escape this kind of area. And for fiction writing, I felt very comfortable writing about this community for those reasons. And I also like to set my stories in the winter because I think that adds another element of, you know, again, being trapped, because the snow and the bitter winds can really make people just hunker down. And I think all of these elements, especially in the kind of stories that I write, add suspense and add to the mystery. And I've had many people say that they feel like the towns themselves are characters. And to me, that is a huge compliment, because it really is a character, these towns.
And the weather you mentioned, it is a character as well. And though you want to hunker down, these characters do not. They are out and about in it, which kind of adds a vulnerability, I think, to some of what they're going through. So let's get into the story and talk about Cap. He is really the central character who we come to understand this story through. And he's even keeled in a way, and he seems to withhold judgment of others, except with regard to himself, perhaps. And he seems to be kind of a galvanizing person in this town. But he's also a person who left and came back and took on this role. So talk a little bit about Cap.
Yeah, Cap, to me, he's a very, on the outside, he seems to be this very strong, stable person. But on the inside, he is really riddled with doubt. He grapples with his own faith, and he grapples with addiction. And, you know, when you're a pastor, especially in these kind of communities, you're always on. You know, everyone sees you at the market, they see you on the street. And typically when you go to your pastor, you need something from that individual. You need advice, you need some guidance, you need to unload some secrets that you've been carrying. And Cap absorbs all of this, he gathers all of this, and he has his own secrets and his own mistakes from the past, but he doesn't have anybody to release that to. So, you know, when I was developing the story, I was really drawn to having the main character be a pastor. And you know, like I said, he struggles with his faith. And I think in the end, it's not exactly what you believe in, but it's like who you believe in. And it's the power of community. And that's what makes Cap continue on and continue his journey. And I think, you know, it has an uplifting message at the end, that the power of community is amazing. And we all need each other to really survive.
Yet this community goes through some challenges during the telling of this story. And, you know, getting back to the whole small town element, these people know each other and have known each other a long time. Yet there still are secrets, and a lot of the characters in the book do have secrets. And we've said that the book opens with a body and blood. So this this is a mystery, and there's a lot of suspense in the book, but there's also the longevity of these relationships. There seems to be at once this friction between people, maybe because of how long they've been around each other, but also this need and trust and affection too.
So yeah, these characters, you know, they all went to school together and they've always been involved in each other's lives, whether they wanted to or not. Again, living in a small community, that's just how it happens. You know, you have one school, you have one grocery store, you know, one hardware store. So your lives intersect on a daily basis, you know, whereas when you live in a bigger city, you could go weeks without seeing someone you know at the market. But, you know, it also complicates things because you know almost everything about each other, you know, mistakes they've made, acts that they've committed in the past. But like in this story, I think that, you know, most people do carry some kind of secret, something that they don't want other people to know. And when that happens, it just festers and it doesn't always end well when a secret is carried too long. And I think that's one of the themes in my story is that, you know, the power of truth is the thing that can be very healing and is really essential to you know, living the life that you really want to live.
You mentioned Tess, who is another one of the central characters, and she's an outsider that comes into the story. And so everybody in town notices her and that she has an accident, a car accident, and Cap rescues her from this situation and shelters her, takes her in. And she is deaf. And her silent world seems to bring into relief, in a way, what is happening around her and the people in the town who she relates with. And I wonder why you made her deaf.
Yeah, as I developed the story and the characters, a previous draft of this story, Tess was a very different character. And as you know, you go through your various rewrites and edits, something was just missing with Tess. I didn't have her down. You know, I feel like I had the voice of Cap and the voice of Sheriff Lester and the voice of all the other characters down. I knew how they spoke and what they were thinking, but with Tess, I couldn't figure it out. And then one day I was just on a walk and I just had this epiphany that, well, I don't have her voice, but maybe she doesn't have a voice, literally. And I just ran with that. And I really was so excited that I landed there because some people would see deafness as a deficit. But I really see it as Tess's greatest strength. And, you know, her lack of a voice in some ways, you know, it pushes some people back and makes them nervous in the small town. You know, A, she's a stranger, which is really strange for these people. And B, you know, she's deaf and this community has never interacted with a deaf person. So there is some resistance from some community members. But Cap, you know, the person that needs a confidant the most, finds the perfect person to talk to and will listen to him. And their relationships evolve to a point that they really kind of save each other. You know, in the beginning, like you say, I have Cap saving her, but in the end, she really saves Cap.
Yes, yes. Just in your telling this about how you evolved the characters and maybe there was a sticking point with her, but the characters were so richly drawn that I felt like I could just visualize them in the what they were wearing or how they looked. And I don't even know that you fully even described that necessarily, but there was such a real tangible feeling of these characters and their relationships with each other, that though this is a mystery, a murder mystery, that the pacing and your characters seem to have this life outside of that in a way, that it seems almost like a character study with this mystery kind of infused into it. Or that was my experience of reading it.
First, that's a huge compliment to hear that your characters, you feel like you can see what they're wearing and how they walk. I mean, that to me is that's the biggest compliment I can get, because I've lived with these characters for over 5 years, and yes, this is a story that has a mystery in it, but that really to me isn't the most important thing. You know, that's compelling, but it's really about the dynamic and the relationships between these people in this small community. And I do spend a lot of time developing characters. I'm not a fast writer, but I think once I find the story I want to tell, it's really important for me to be a character-driven author.
That's interesting that you say you're not a fast writer. I think the pacing of the book was also sort of unfolding in a way, whereas in some mysteries, I'm going to say there's a different sort of energy or pacing to it. And I almost felt that just like sometimes the snow was lightly falling, I felt there was just this slow unfolding of the story that for a reader is very satisfying. And I will also bring up that you use a mechanism of the book opens on Good Friday, the day that Jesus Christ was crucified, died, and was buried. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that has any relevance, but then we go back 15 days before this body is discovered. And that then creates its own cloud or remove that allows this story to unfold kind of separately from the body. And then further, these characters have their own reminiscences. So can you talk about how you used that mechanism or came to use that mechanism of kind of going back in time?
Well, it's true that, you know, this is a story that has a mystery in it, but I don't follow maybe some of the standards of an investigation and some aha moments when things are discovered. It's really about, you know, peeling back the onion layers with these characters and, you know, finding out why they are so broken and why they maybe treat other people badly. You know, there's a character in it that is probably not well liked at the very beginning. He's very unfaithful to his wife, which is not forgivable, but we do discover the genesis of that, of why he chose and chooses to do that. So, you know, to me, it is the pacing, and it's like the slow burn effect of the story. And I think what I wanted to do was, you know, set up this crime that happened and then pull back, because, you know, I don't reveal who was killed at the beginning, and you know, we don't know who possibly was the person that committed the crime. So I wanted to pull back, you know, 15 days earlier, introduce all these characters in the town and give them all, you know, a little chink in their armor of they have some very serious flaws, and they might have some motive of doing something to someone. And then it was, you know, a delicate balance of moving the story forward, developing the characters, showing what kind of mistakes they're making. And then also this crime and this buildup of, you know, I'm hoping that readers are on the edge of their seat wondering, well, who died and who committed the crime? But, you know, in a literary sense, that they're very satisfied with these rich characters that they maybe would relate to, they grew up next to, or they lived with. So I think that was my approach to how I told the story.
Yes. There are several other deaths in the book, aside from the opening body. But they are, I don't know, presented in various ways. And Cap, as the preacher in the town, he has to be present to people and families when they die. And I thought it was interesting that you had these other deaths in the book. And I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Like I said earlier, you know, Cap, he's always on. So he has to be there for the community, whether they, you know, attend his church or not. He's there to give his services to the community. And these other deaths, there's two deaths. Both are, you know, pretty disturbing, but to me, realistic. And some of these characters are composite characters that I grew up with. You know, with the first death, you know, Cap, it was a man that lives in the community that had no money. He was essentially, you know, he was a homeless person, essentially, and had no resources. So Cap took it upon himself to give this man a proper send-off, to pay respects to the life that he lived. And even Cap had he had this connection to this person that I don't think anybody else in the community knew about. They had this bond, you know, this pastor and this man that lived in a shack down by the county dump. They had this connection. And to me, that is interesting, you know. And then the other death that you referred to, again, it was based on some composite characters that I built for people that I grew up living next to. And, you know, although it's tragic, it gives Cap some kind of clarity. It helps him move forward in some way. And he helps the family around that person that died. And I just think that it's beautiful in some way. And, you know, some people might think it's dark, but, you know, death is all around us. You know, it's what we try to avoid, but it's, you know, we all experience it. We're all touched by it. And you have to really connect with one another to get through it.
Yes. Alcohol also seems central. And I wonder if this is a reflection of, I don't know, a sort of hopelessness or maybe a masking of honesty and secrets that people are harboring. But not just with Cap, but there were other instances where people were just drinking a lot and to the point where I noticed it. So to me, that you're using that as a mechanism.
Yes. I've struggled with addiction over the years, and I come from a family where alcoholism runs pretty deep. So it's something that I've lived with, and just growing up with, you know, families of that are alcoholics, there's a lot of secrets, shame in that. And I felt that I could be very honest with that when giving Cap those same addictions and weaknesses. And it's also, you know, that kind of community growing up there in the, you know, the 80s, drinking was just part of life. People would openly drink and drive. And if there was a party, there was absolutely going to be alcohol there. And I'm not saying every household did that, but it was very common, at least to the circles that I was in. So it was just something that was just everyday life. And I think with Cap, his addiction on top of his grappling with his own faith are really just some of the most important elements of the story. And, you know, how you can get through these kind of crises and these, I guess you could say, afflictions.
Yeah. I tell you, if I had a bottle of Wild Turkey in my house, I would have started drinking it. There are times I would have poured myself two fingers there. I'm talking with Samuel W. Gailey, and his most recent novel is Come Away From Her. I think this is your third novel, is it?
Yes, correct.
And you mentioned it's taken you 5 years to write this particular book. And I wonder if you want to tell us anything else about your life as a writer, as an author.
Well, yeah, most of my stories, or all of my stories, I should say, do take place in northeastern Pennsylvania. And they all take place in small communities. And then with this one, I returned to the same area, the same communities that my debut novel, Deep Winter, took place in. And there's a few characters from Deep Winter that show up and come away from her, like Sheriff Lester and a few other characters. And I like that. And you don't need to read previous books to appreciate these stories. But for fans that had read Deep Winter, I think it's kind of fun when you see characters show up in another story. And the current book that I'm working on, it's more of a historical fiction piece. It takes place in the 1790s in northeastern Pennsylvania. And it's about this, you know, Mennonite family that is settling into the valley. And it's how these parents face the reality of when they discover that one of their daughters was capable of a very violent act. And so again, I'm dealing with Pennsylvania winters and the isolation. And then I'm moving it back even further. You know, when you live in the 1790s, obviously there's even more isolation. So that's my current story, and I'm really excited about that one. And hopefully it won't take me 5 years to get that one out there.
Well, it sounds like it may involve a lot more research if you're going back that far. Did the Mennonites were in Pennsylvania as early as late 1700s?
Yes. So it is a lot of research. It is, you know, what they wear, what they eat, where they live. So it is, it's very research heavy, and I've got a lot more research to do, but it's, you know, my other stories didn't have that element of research, and it's really been eye-opening to write when you need, you can't just fabricate things, you know, things need to be factual. It's been very fun.
So thank you, Samuel, for talking with us today, and look forward to future reads with you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, and I love your questions and the conversation.
Samuel W. Gailey, Come Away From Her is his book. Earlier we heard from Donaldson Brown with her novel, Because I Loved You. Our music today is from Mean Mary and her 2019 album, Cold. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for sharing this time with us. We have production assistance from Will Penny and Mark Prell. We are a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media. Stream us online and subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. It's a novel idea.